We're in 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, and we're going to be looking at verse 3 this evening. And I hope you don't have a bunch of questions afterwards, because this passage has always been kind of a mystery to me, in the sense that I would read it, but I never studied it out. And so some of the things that were a puzzle still remained a puzzle. But I really think that it's getting clearer as I go through the details. So, you know, we'll take it a verse at a time and pray for clarity. But in our study last time, we noted that Paul told the Thessalonians that they shouldn't be attempting to figure out the when issue of the rapture, which is the normal. That's the normal default issue. You're taught about the rapture in chapter 4, and so then you want to know, well, when's this going to happen? Well, he says they knew perfectly that the day of the Lord would come as a thief in the night, which means you're not going to be told this. And that is reinforced by Jesus' own comment in Acts 1, where the apostles ask whether he was going to establish the kingdom now after his resurrection. And he said, it is not for you to know the times and the seasons. And that apparently is still true. Now, I say that in this regard. There is a statement in the Gospels where Jesus said that nobody knows the timing of the coming, not even the angels, not even the Son of Man. And that has caused some people to have a little problem, because Jesus was God in the flesh. He's supposed to know, you know. I really believe that when he said it was true, but after his ascension, he knows as well as the Father does when it's going to be. But by the same token, I think that the rest of New Testament Revelation gives some indicators that are legitimate signs of the times. And the fact is, if you know if, and this is not a easy if, but if you know when the 70th week of Daniel starts, we think we know what the event will be. It'll be a peace covenant or a covenant with Israel by the Antichrist. But whether that's a secret thing or an openly broadcast thing, we're not told. So there is an if about that. But if you know when the covenant is consummated, you can just mark it off. Two periods of 1,260 days each, 2,520 days, and the coming will be then. You know that. So there will be a generation where that statement by Jesus isn't true anymore. That not only will the angels know, but the people on the earth will know if they give heed to the scriptures. So when I say that apparently Jesus' statement is not for you to know the times of the season is still holding, it's simply because Paul told the Thessalonians, you know perfectly well, that the biblical fact is the day of the Lord is coming as a thief in the night, and what the relationship of the rapture of the day of the Lord is only implied by that comment. There are, in verse 1, times and seasons. Multiple times, multiple seasons. But they may be like the strands of a stranded copper wire that has a case over it to hold them all together, but they are individual strands. But if you clip that wire at any point, those individual strands all come together at the same point where you clipped it, and therefore the times, which would be the wires, and the seasons, which would be the end things that are right down close to the fulfillment of whatever the time was set up for, a bunch of those are going to come together. All within the last, at least the 70th week of Daniel. So there are multiple things that God has declared will happen. Those are the times for each one of those things to happen. The seasons will be when they happen, and whether the seasons overlap with each other or not, that's a whole issue. That's why people have prophecy conferences and try to figure it all out. But basically, he's just saying, there is a connection between the rapture and the day of the Lord, but it's not real clearly stated, except as we get into the details of the text here. But this evening, having told them that the rapture is in some way connected to the coming of the day of the Lord, and is subject of times and seasons, multiple events with multiple points in history when they'll occur, the real question, or the question we face, is whether or not the rapture is a part of the day of the Lord, or an event that is outside of that framework and yet not outside of the historical setting of that framework. In other words, will the rapture be a part of the day of the Lord, or will it happen just before the day of the Lord begins, or will there be some time in between the rapture and the beginning of the day of the Lord? All those kind of questions that are swirling around there. And the implication of him going from the rapture in chapter 4 into the times and seasons and the day of the Lord in chapter 5, the implication of that is that the rapture is going to occur closely to the timing of the day of the Lord in some way, and it may be a catalyst for the beginning of the day of the Lord. The rapture is going to create massive havoc on the earth. And is that massive havoc of having millions of people suddenly disappear, just suddenly clothes lying on the ground, cars without drivers, all that kind of scenario, will that havoc that is created by that and the paralysis that will occur on multiple levels in the culture when that happens, will that be a catalyst for the beginning of the day of the Lord or not? You know, we're just reaching here for possible issues, but I think that the difference between the rapture and the day of the Lord in terms of timing things is, if the rapture is a part of the day of the Lord, it's not as imminent as we have thought. And if it's not, our grasp of imminence remains. But the strong implication is the day of the Lord will be pretty hard on the heels of it. Because that's the only thing that makes any sense here. If their question is, when's the rapture going to happen? And Paul says, basically, you're not going to know that because you're not going to know the times and the seasons, and the day of the Lord is going to come as a thief. That flow of thinking implies that the rapture and the day of the Lord are somehow fairly closely connected, time-wise. I really believe that the rapture is separate from the day of the Lord, the beginning of the day of the Lord. It may actually be the catalyst for some of the things that are predicted, but that's just because I see Paul being emphatic in this paragraph about some of the characteristics of the coming day of the Lord and in the strong encouragement in this paragraph not to mimic those who are going to be caught off guard by it. So there's a connection there. So our study this evening is really going to go in verse 3, where Paul is actually explaining his thief thesis. The day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night. So verse 3, it says, when they are saying peace and safety, then destruction will come upon them. The word, well, New American Standard says, suddenly, like birth pangs upon a woman with child, and they shall not escape. We'll talk about that translation as we work our way through. But clearly he's saying, some day is saying peace and safety, and then, poof, it's going to happen. Catch them flat-footed. So the first thing I want us to talk about is, who's this they that'll be saying peace and safety? It's an unspecified they. It's not even emphatic. It's just attached to the verb. It's a third-person plural. They are saying. So when we talk about the they, since Paul doesn't say who the they are, we're going to have to dig out what he means by that. Paul really doesn't come out and say in any direct statement who the they are, but there are some strong implications from some of the things he does say. And the reason that the they is important is because there are different biblical prophetic scenarios that argue for a different understanding of those who are saying peace and safety. For example, if you decide that the they is Israel, so that it's the Jews who are saying peace and safety when sudden destruction comes, then the implication is strongly backwards to Daniel chapter 9. Because in Daniel chapter 9, we're told that the Antichrist, for the 70th week of Daniel, for 1 week, will make a covenant with the people of Israel. And that covenant is going to last a short 7-year period. And what I mean by short is they're figuring on 360-day years for the 7 years, instead of 365 and a quarter, whatever. It's not a lot of days difference between 7 360-day years and 7 365 and a quarter day years. What, 7 5 is 35, and then 7 quarters. So there's 37 or 8 days difference. But the point is, biblically, it's 1260 and 1260. Those are two sets of 360 day years. Point is this. Daniel 9 says that the thing that will kick off that 70th week is a covenant between Israel and this Antichrist that's coming. And the question then is, why would Israel make a covenant with Antichrist in any case? I mean, what would be the point of a covenant that would bind Israel to some up-and-coming political figure in the world? What would be the pressure on Israel to cause them to do that? And characteristically, what we've heard taught, and I've probably taught it myself, is that things are going to be bad enough in the world that Israel's going to feel the strong pressure to deal with the conflict that's going on. And the offer of the Antichrist is, look, I'll guarantee your peace and safety for you as a nation if you'll just sign this covenant with me. I'll make sure that these threatening things don't develop and devour you. I'll guarantee that. And there are two things that are going on there. One is that the person offering that has to be a person of sufficient stature to make that kind of offer that would be believable. And that's the entire scenario of the Antichrist and his political power in the world. And the other is the pressure that's on Israel to make a covenant like that. Because it's really a covenant with death. They don't know it. Because he's going to break the covenant himself in the middle of the week. And then he's going to set himself up in the temple of Israel as God. So he's going to desecrate their new temple and everything. They don't know what's going to happen in the midst of the week. But that scenario is rooted to the idea that the day and here that are saying peace and safety are Jews. So that's one scenario. But on the other hand, Ezekiel 38 and 39 reveals a scenario where the nation that is in the uttermost parts of the north of Israel, which today is Russia, is going to make an alliance with a whole bunch of nations that are all listed in upper northern Africa and around. And when you look at the ones that are identified, they're all Muslim nations today. So Ezekiel 38 and 39, that's going to be fulfilled in our generation, means Russia and all of the Muslim nations that are associated by name in Ezekiel. This prophecy is a prophecy where Russia and its military might and the Muslim nations and all of their military might come into Israel and get on the mountains of Israel, threatening to destroy the nation of Israel. And then God steps in and destroys those armies, decimates them, so that there's just a smattering of them that are able to go back to their homes. In other words, he's going to destroy one of the major power factors, two of the major power factors in our present world, Russia and all the Muslim nations. Well, if Russia and the Muslims are all decimated, people may well be saying, oh, man, now we have peace and safety. Because, depending on your perspective, the United States has not been known as an aggressor in terms of trying to force people to come into our way of looking at things across the board. I mean, there has been some nation building on our part that we didn't have any business doing, but nonetheless, most of the deportment of the West has been really not aggressive. It's been the communists and the Muslims who have forced the issues and caused the conflicts and all that. So what if God just destroys all of those national structures in terms of their military abilities? He's going to create a power vacuum that's going to leave the nations that are historically not all that aggressive in control. And so people in the world could say, now we've got peace and safety. So the day makes a difference. If the day is the people of the world, then it's probable that Ezekiel 38 and 39 are going to happen before the beginning of the day of the Lord. If the day is the Jews, then it's probable that he's talking about Daniel 9 and the covenant thing. And the question is, well, which is more likely? Well, that depends. Because technically, the concept of the day of the Lord is an Old Testament concept that is contained in the writings, the sacred writings of the Jewish people. The idea that there would be a bunch of Gentiles who were familiar enough with the Old Testament scriptures of Israel that they would even have a clue what Paul was talking about, that just isn't probable. I mean, the Jews were noted for being students of their scriptures, but the Gentiles were noted for hating the Jews, so they probably didn't study the Jewish scriptures. So, technically, you could say, well, the Jews that Paul was writing to were the only ones who would even understand this Day of the Lord terminology, unless he made reference to it in his time in Thessalonica in his teaching. The interesting thing about it is that Acts 17:4, in the record about the people in Thessalonica who responded to the gospel, says that there were a great multitude of God-fearing Greeks in Thessalonica that responded to the gospel. So there were a great number of people to whom this letter was written who had no Jewish background. It was that great number that caused the jealousy of the Jews in Philippi to send people down to Thessalonica to stir the pot. They couldn't stand having somebody have that kind of powerful impact and not be them. It's this jealousy thing. But nonetheless, it seems to me that if Paul's going to address something that addresses a great multitude of non-Jewish people, then probably they that are saying peace and safety are not just the Jews, it's the inhabitants of the world. And then when you go back to the Old Testament scriptures and look at the Day of the Lord as a theme, and look at the things that are declared to going to be happening during the Day of the Lord, you get this huge impression from the Old Testament that it's going to be a worldwide thing. It's going to affect a whole lot of nations, not just Israel. And then when you go into the New Testament, and particularly the book of the Revelation in Matthew 24 and places like that, you get the same impression that this Day of the Lord, this time of horrible judgment, this time of Jacob's great trouble, it's going to be a worldwide phenomenon. So the sudden destruction that's going to fall on those who are saying peace and safety is probable. He's talking about the inhabitants of the world. The world is going to be saying, finally, all these people have been stirring up all this trouble and creating such havoc and producing such feelings of insecurity and the lack of peace. Finally, those people have all been destroyed or decimated or their power is gone, so we don't have to worry about them anymore. I find it kind of interesting. This thought I've just realized this right now. This morning when the pastor at the church where we attend started his sermon out, he started out by talking about all the places in the world where there are wars going on, and there's gobs of them. Some of them they were rated. If 10,000 or more people per year were being killed, then they were these wars, and there were five of them. And then those that caused 9,999 and down to 1,000, there was a whole slew of those. And then those that were under 1,000 a year, there was a whole slew of those. But if you took the totals of all of those wars and their time frame, how they've played out, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people have been killed in the last decade in wars. So the idea that peace and safety is not a big deal is probably a dream. Peace and safety is a big deal to a whole host of people in all kinds of places in the world. It may not be such a big deal for us in the United States, in, you know, here in Humble, or Liberty Dayton, Humble area, in Texas, in our setting in history, we may not be worrying about peace and safety so much. But apparently there's a whole bunch of people in the country that are, because this has been one of the greatest periods of sales for guns that the history of the United States has seen. So there are a lot of people who are worried. Things happen like that thing that happened in France, and people began to think, well, what would keep that from happening here? And especially when one of the news stories is about a 13-year-old girl and an 18-year-old boy that they can't even find. They did, by the way, find them this morning. But when a 13-year-old and an 18-year-old can go on a crime spree and be stealing vehicles and all kinds of stuff, and escape law enforcement for several days, then you wonder, okay, how safe am I? And the answer is not very. So, I've said all of that to say this. I think that the they who are saying this are the inhabitants of the world. This is not limited to the Jews. This is a worldwide fear setup, and something's going to have to happen to bring in a statement where peace and safety is the siren call. And I really think that Ezekiel 38 and 39 is the prophecy of the scenario that will bring about the world's ability to say, whew, finally, all those people that want to kill everybody that doesn't agree with them, they're gone. However, whatever. I mean, God says in Ezekiel 38 39 that he's going to destroy these nations on the mountains of Israel to prove that Israel's God is the God. And so there's going to be this huge theological statement from heaven by this action. But there are always going to be people who say, well, that wasn't really God. That was just the way things happened. You know, there was a fault line running through. And, you know, just be blind to what's as clear as the nose on your face. There's always going to be people like that. So whether God gets his desired result of being known as the God accomplished throughout the world is a question, but the fact is, I think that people, when all of the instigators of violence and killing people that don't agree with them, when that's handled, everybody's going to have this huge sigh of relief. Peace and safety. Now, when we were studying the idea of somebody saying something back in chapter 4, verse 15, I made a big deal out of saying, and I may have oversold it. I mean, it's a real possibility that I did, but I went back and looked at that Lego, and I did decide this. Whether it's emphatic or not, Lego means I believe this. So when the people say peace and safety, they are expressing a belief. They believe that peace and safety have finally arrived. And if you stop and think about it, if Boko Haram is gone and all the enemies of Israel are destroyed and all of the Muslim hordes are decimated and Russia is wiped out as an international power structure, we'll all just be saying, man, now we can have peace and safety. And the word for peace is the general term for peace. It's more than just the absence of conflict, but it is at least that. And then the word for safety, that word's not used much in the New Testament, but when it is used, you can see it real clearly. It means, you know, things are locked up tight. You don't have to worry about this. In other words, the idea of safety is one of two things. Either you've got enough locks and bars on your doors and windows that you're not worried at all, or there isn't anything out there to be worried about. One or the other. And the idea of peace and safety here is not the locks and the bars. It's the fact that there is nothing out there to be afraid of, because they've all been neutralized. So when they are saying, when the inhabitants of the world, as a statement of faith, are saying, okay, now we've got peace and safety, Paul says, then destruction will come upon them. Suddenly, like birth pangs upon a woman with child. The problem here is that Paul is saying that what they're saying as an article of faith is absolutely, completely false. It is not true. You're not going to have peace and safety. The fact that they're saying peace and safety only means that they don't have any visible indications of any nations or groups that can disturb their peace and or safety. And there are a couple implications about that. One of them is that peace and safety have been missing for so long that people have begun to long for them. They want peace and safety, and that means no peace and no safety have been around long enough that everybody's on edge and have been on edge long enough that they say, man, this is nice to have all of that off our shoulders. Now we have peace and safety. But that statement, peace and safety, also implies that there is now a huge power vacuum in the balances of power that have been in place when both peace and safety don't exist. And it's really interesting in our historical setting to see how things have come about, because there was a time when if you had the atomic weapons, you could intimidate your opponents into not doing anything really stupid. And that created a power struggle where everybody that could build nuclear weapons was building massive numbers of them in order to keep each other from doing something called first strike. Because no matter what happens, whoever strikes first is going to be decimated by the one that strikes second. Because, for example, Russia's a major nuclear power. They have the capacity to do a first strike thing. But one thing they can't do, they cannot eliminate our submarine force. And we have some nuclear subs that are armed with nuclear missiles that each have between 10 and 20 nuclear warheads that can be individually identified to go to a certain target. So you fire one of these rockets up, and then these multiple warheads separate and go pew, pew, pew. So if you've got 3, 4, 5 submarines, and they all have these nuclear capabilities, and they can all hit multiple targets, because one firing gets 10 to 20 cities, and there's several in each sub. If you have 4 or 5 of these submarines, there ain't nobody safe anywhere. I mean, blow up the whole world. And so that is a deterrent, because there is no weapon at this point that Russia can neutralize the nuclear subs that are underneath the ocean all the time, going around, 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 waiting for something stupid to happen. So the point simply is that there will be this massive imbalance in the balance of power thing, where all the power now rests in the hands of some who don't appear to be all that aggressively involved in trying to run the world. What they don't know is that that's going to bring the Antichrist to power. He will step into this power vacuum with a glib tongue and a false prophet, and in a little while, he'll be ruling the world without anybody realizing it. This happens this quickly. So there's a power vacuum that's going to be established by whatever happens to bring peace and safety as a worldwide statement. So the worldwide power that appears to be most peaceful has to be dominant, and those formerly disturbers of the peace and safety have to have been completely neutralized. That's the scenario that's implied by the statement that they're going to be saying peace and safety, but what they don't realize is that this peace and safety era is a significant illusion. And that illusion, according to this verse, will be destroyed by this, what the King James calls sudden destruction. The New American Standard translates it, then destruction will come upon them suddenly. That word suddenly, I guess, can mean suddenly, like birth pangs on a woman. She knows she's going to have them, but she doesn't know exactly when they're going to set on. So when they do, they catch her suddenly. But when I looked at it, the word actually means unanticipated. You didn't realize that this was going to happen, so it caught you flat-footed. Now, with a woman in birth pangs, there's a sense in which she's caught flat-footed by the onset of her birth process. There's another sense in which, yeah, I've been expecting this for 9 months, and it's getting close to the time, so yeah, I'm kind of sort of ready for this. But all of the joking stuff about people when the first real onset comes, and then the husband panics, and the, you know, all of those stories are built around the idea that, well, if we'd have just known it was going to happen right now, we'd have been a little better prepared. Well, the whole idea there is that this destruction is totally unexpected. And that's what the people are dealing with, because when there was no peace and no safety, they kind of lived on the edge of the threat of being destroyed at any time by these crazies that are running around here shooting people and all that kind of thing. And they didn't know whether they were going to be safe or not. And so they were always kind of anticipating that they were going to maybe be subjected to this. And so they got out their, you know, concealed carry and all that kind of stuff. But peace and safety means, hey, I don't have to carry my gun around anymore. I'm safe. And then all of a sudden, the roof falls in on you. And you just didn't anticipate this at all. And that's Paul's concept in verse 3, that they're going to be seriously deluded. It's going to be an article of faith to them that, yeah, the world has finally gotten to this position where now we have peace and safety because all of the proponents of violence have been neutralized. And the interesting thing about that is that the destruction that is dealt with here doesn't necessarily mean, though it can include, being killed. But being destroyed doesn't necessarily mean losing your life. It could be that you're destroyed in a number of ways in which you have decided your life is characterized by these good things, and when they're all gone, then you've been destroyed, but you're still alive, breathing, and having to deal with it. Well, that's part of the idea, is that destruction can have a pre-physical death reality. It can include physical death, but also it can actually include being rejected by God and sent to hell. So this incremental idea of destruction just collapsing on you when you were totally unaware that it could, and it can be, you know, any from the range of minor losses to major final disaster in being cast into hell and rejected by God. That's Paul's statement, that this is going to happen to them. This destruction is going to come upon them. And he says in a final word in verse 3, they will not escape. So he's making a case for the fact that the day of the Lord has a specific kind of setup in the world that is going to be created by a one world development of non-aggression, where everybody's expecting, now that the aggressors have all been decimated, we now have peace and safety. The day of the Lord, Paul says, requires that mindset. And that's partly why I think that the rapture is not a part of it, because that kind of mindset is impossible today. Which would mean, if the rapture is part of the day of the Lord, the rapture is impossible today. And yet, Paul says, don't think that. Don't think that the rapture is impossible. You might be one of those who are alive and remain. And that the imminency concept is a very real concept, because the inescapability of the disaster that the day of the Lord is going to bring into play. And by the way, in the Old Testament, the day of the Lord is not all bad stuff. There's a dark period of the day and there's a light period of the day. I mentioned that last time. The day of the Lord has some phenomenally good prophecies associated with it in the Old Testament, but not here. This day of the Lord issue is the dark period of the day is going to fall on them unexpectedly and they will not escape. And that inescapability means that you couldn't possibly look forward to this in any sense of the term. You do not want the day of the Lord to come while you're still here on this planet. And that's what Paul is, in a very real sense, saying in this whole paragraph, that you don't have to worry about it, because there is this doctrine in chapter 4. where you'll be caught up to be with the Lord, and your joy will be established in the Lord. And you're not a part of this. In fact, he even says, verse 4, which we'll get into next week, Lord willing, you're not in the darkness that the day should overtake you. It's not going to happen to you. So we're going to be discussing some of the issues that are raised in verses 4 and following, where he talked to the Thessalonians about the day of the Lord and what their attitude should be in regard to it. And the question that comes to mind is, why do they even have to worry about it? The rapture is going to happen before it happens. What's the big deal? Well, we'll talk about that in the weeks to come, and that's one of the things that's not on the questions for tonight. But I think we can look at verse 3 and say this very firmly. The day of the Lord, at least initially, is not something that anybody's going to be looking forward to. The inescapability factor is declared. They will not escape. And that's not an absolutely all-inclusive thing, because from our understanding of some of the things that are going to be going on in the 70th week of Daniel, there's going to be a whole new group of people coming to know Christ as their Savior, being born again. And some of those, the Bible says, will endure to the end and be saved, which means they'll go right out of the 70th week into the kingdom of the Christ without ever dying. They just go right in. That means that even though they're here during the onset of the day of the Lord and all that stuff, that the inescapability factor is not absolute. There are going to be some people who are going to escape at least the spiritual side of that. Now, the judgments that are going to be poured out are going to affect believers to some degree. There's going to be a lot of loss of life, both of believers and unbelievers, during the period. But the they shall not escape, I believe, is a reference to the they who are saying peace and safety when they have no reliance on God at all. They're just looking at the world situation saying, okay, finally we've got it. Jesus did say, you won't see or enter the kingdom unless you're born again. So by the end of the 70th week, there won't be any believers left. When Jesus comes back, whatever unbelievers are still here, they're all going to be judged. They're going to be put to death. It's kind of going to be a rapture in reverse. If you're not a believer when Jesus comes, you're going to be put to death. You're not going to see or enter the kingdom if you're not a believer. So what's Paul's point? Well, I believe the first point is the rapture's off the table in terms of any revelation concerning its timing. That's not for us to know. It's an imminent thing that we're supposed to be anticipating, looking forward to, but we can't be sure when it's going to happen. The day of the Lord is also off the table in terms of any ability of men to read the signs of the times with any degree of accuracy, because he says, it's going to come like a thief. You know this perfectly well. It's not going to be something that you can anticipate, know when it's going to happen. It's not going to be that kind of thing. Thieves don't break in and steal while people are sitting in the house with their shotguns loaded because they're expecting them. They break in and steal because nobody's expecting it. It's totally unexpected. And so, for those two things, the timing issues are off the table. You cannot decide when this is going to happen with any kind of accuracy. And then, if we understand the imminency properly, chapter 4, the rapture, those people won't even be here to say peace and safety. Because they'll already be in final peace and safety. They'll have already been caught up to be with the Lord. So that's where we are when we come to the end of verse 3. He's just explaining his thief thesis. The day of the Lord is going to come like a thief. That means this and this and this and this. But primarily it means that the world is going to be led to believe by some events that happen to think that now, finally, we have peace and safety. And that's exactly what's not going to be. Because destruction is going to fall unexpectedly when they will not escape. That's the point. Could have said all that and skipped all the other, 45 minutes? But got to say all that stuff. It's part of the job. So, aside from, I'll just tell you if I can't answer your question, but if you have a question or comment, we can discuss whatever this particular verse has raised.